Batso started back towards the head of the column, but Juba called him back. "My son, I am deeply, deeply troubled."
"It grieves me, little mother. What troubles you?"
"Tanasi tells me that all the white folk are to be kissed with steel."
"All of them?" Batso nodded.
"Nomusa, who is more than a mother to me, must she also die, my son? She is so good and kind to our people."
Gently, Batso took her by the arm and led her off the path, where they could not be overheard.
"That very kindness which you speak of makes her the most dangerous of all of them," Batso explained. "The love that you bear for her weakens us all. If I say to you, 'We will spare this one,' then you will ask, 'Can we not also spare her little son and her daughters and their children?'"
Batso shook his head. "No, I tell you truly, if I were to spare one of them, it would be One Bright Eye himself."
"One Bright Eye?" Juba started. "I do not understand. He is cruel and fierce without understanding."
"When our warriors look on his face and hear his voice, they are reminded once again of all the wrongs we have suffered, and they become strong and angry. When they look upon Nomusa, they become soft and hesitant. She must be amongst the first to die, and I will send a good man to do that work."
"You say they must all die?" Juba asked.
"This one that comes now, will he die also?"
Juba pointed ahead, where the path wound lazily beneath the spreading flat-topped acacia trees. There was a horseman cantering towards them from the direction of the Harkness mine, and even at this distance there was no mistaking the set of his powerful shoulders and his easy and yet arrogant seat in the saddle.
"Look at him," Juba went on. "It was you who gave him the praise name of Little Hawk. You have often told me how as youths you worked shoulder to shoulder and ate from the same pot. You were proud when you described the wild falcon that you caught and trained together."
Juba's voice sank lower.
"Will you kill this man that you call your brother, my son?"
"I will let no other do it," Batso affirmed. "I will do it with my own hand to make sure it is swift and clean, and after him I will kill his woman and his son. When that is done, there will be no turning back."
"You have become a hard man, my son," Juba whispered, with terrible shadows of regret in her eyes and an ache in her voice.
Batso turned away from her and stepped back onto the path. Ralph Ballantyne saw him and waved his hat above his head.
"Batso," he laughed as he rode up, "will I ever learn never to doubt you? You bring me more than the 200 you promised."
Ralph Ballantyne crossed the southern boundary of King's Lynn, but it was another 2 hours riding before he made out the milky grey loom of the homestead coppies on the horizon. The veldt through which he rode was silent now and almost empty. It chilled Ralph, so that his expression was gloomy and his thoughts dark. Where several months ago his father's herds of plump, multicoloured cattle had grazed, the new grass was springing up again, dense and green and untrodden, as though to veil the white bones with which the earth was strewn so thickly. Only Ralph's warning had saved Zuga Ballantyne from complete financial disaster. He had managed to sell off some small portion of his herds to Gwai Cattle Ranches, a BSA company subsidiary, before the rinderpest struck King's Lynn. But he had lost the rest of his cattle, and their bones gleamed like strings of pearls amongst the new green grass. Ahead of Ralph, amongst the mimosa trees, was one of his father's cattle posts, and Ralph stood in the saddle and shaded his eyes, puzzled by the haze of pink dust which hung over the old stockade. The dust had been raised by hooves, and there was the sharp crack of a trek-whip, a sound that had not been heard in Matabele land for many months. Even at a distance he recognised the figures, silhouetted upon the railing of the stockade like a pair of scraggly old crows.
"Yan Shirut!" he called as he rode up. "Isasi, what are you two old rogues playing at?"
They grinned at him delightedly and scrambled down to greet him.
"Good Lord!"
Ralph's astonishment was unfeigned as he realized what the animals in the stockade were. The curtains of thick dust had hidden them until this minute.
"Is this how you spend your time when I'm away, Isasi? Whose idea is this?"
"Bakela, your father's,"
Isasi's expression instantly became melancholy.
and it is a stupid idea. The fat, sleek animals were striped in vivid black and white, their manes stiff as the bristles in a chimney sweep's broom.
Zebras, by God! Ralph shook his head. How did you round them up?
We used up a dozen good horses chasing them, Jan Schroot explained, his leathery yellow features wrinkled with disapproval. Your father hopes to replace the track oxen with these dumb donkeys. They are as wild and as unreasonable as a Vendor virgin. They bite and kick until you get them in the traces, and then they lie down and refuse to pull.
Isasi spat with disgust. It was manifest folly to try to bridge in a few short months the vast gap between wild animal and domesticated beast of burden. It had taken a millennia of selection and breeding to develop the doughty courage, the willing heart and strong back of the draft bullock. It was a measure of the settler's desperate need for transport that Zuga should even make the attempt.
Isasi, Ralph shook his head, when you've finished this boy's game, I have man's work for you at the railhead camp.
I will be ready to go with you when you return, Isasi promised enthusiastically. I am sick to the stomach with striped donkeys.
Ralph turned to Jan Schroot.
I want to talk to you, old friend.
When they were well beyond the stockade, he asked the little Hottentot,
Did you put your mark on a company paper saying that we had pegged the Harkness claims in darkness?
I would never let you down, Jan Schroot declared proudly. General St. John explained to me, and I put my mark on the paper to save the claims for you and the Major.
He saw Ralph's expression and demanded anxiously,
I did the right thing?
Ralph leaned out of the saddle and clasped the bony old shoulder.
You have been a good and loyal friend to me all my life.
From the day you were born, Jan Schroot declared, when your mama died, I feed you. I held you on my knee.
Ralph opened his saddle bag, and the old Hottentot's eyes gleamed when he saw the bottle of Cape brandy.
Give a dram to Isasi, Ralph told him.
But Jan Schroot clasped the bottle to his bosom as though it was a first-born son.
I wouldn't waste good brandy on a black savage, he declared indignantly,
and Ralph laughed and rode on towards the homestead of King's Lynn. Here there was all the bustle and excitement that he had expected. There were horses that Ralph did not recognize in the paddock below the big thatched house, and amongst them the unmistakable matched white mules of Mr. Rhodes's equipage. The coach itself stood under the trees in the yard, its paintwork a sparkle, and harness ware carefully stacked on the racks in the saddle room beside the stables. Ralph felt his anger flare up when he saw it. His hatred burned like a bellyful of cheap wine, and he could taste the acid of it at the back of his throat. He swallowed hard to control it as he dismounted. Two black grooms ran to take his horse. One of them unstrapped his blanket roll, his saddlebags and rifle scabbard, and ran with them up towards the big house. Ralph followed him, and he was halfway across the lawns when Zuga Ballantyne came out onto the wide stoop, and with a linen table napkin shaded his eyes against the glare. He was still chewing from the luncheon table.
"Ralph, my boy, I didn't expect you until evening."
Ralph ran up the steps, and they embraced. And then Zuga took his arm and led him down the veranda. The walls were hung with trophies of the chase, the long twisted horns of kudu and eland, the gleaming black scimitars of sable and roan antelope, and guarding each side of the double doors that led into the dining room were the immense tusks of the great bull elephant that Zuga Ballantyne had shot on the site of the Harkness mine. These heavy curved shafts of ivory were as tall as a man standing on tiptoe could reach, and thicker than a fat lady's thigh. Zuga and Ralph passed between them into the dining room. Under the thatch it was cool and dark after the brilliant white glare of noon. The floor was of hand-sawn wild teak, and the roof beams of the same material. Jan Schroot had made the long refectory table and the chairs with seats of leather from timber cut on the estate. But the glinting silver was from the Ballantyne family home at King's Lynn in England, a tenuous link between two places of the same name, and yet of such dissimilar aspect. Zuga's empty chair was at the far end of the long table. and facing it down the long board was the familiar, massive, brooding figure that raised his shaggy head as Ralph came in from the stoop.
"Ah, Ralph, it's good to see you."
It amazed Ralph that there was no rancor in either Mr. Rhodes's voice or eyes. Could he have truly put the dispute over the wanky coalfields out of his mind, as though it had never happened? With an effort, Ralph matched his own reaction to the other man's. "How are you, sir?" Ralph actually smiled as he gripped the broad hand with its hard, prominent knuckles. The skin was cool, like that of a reptile. The effect of the poor circulation of the damaged heart. Ralph was pleased to release it, and pass on down the length of the long table. He was not certain that he could long conceal his true feelings from the close scrutiny of those pale, hypnotic eyes. They were all there. The suave little doctor at Mr. Rhodes's right hand, his appropriate station. "Young Ballantyne," he said coldly, offering his hand without rising. "Jamieson," Ralph nodded familiarly, knowing that the deliberate omission of the title would rankle with him, as much as the condescending "young" had annoyed Ralph. On Mr. Rhodes's other hand was a surprising guest. It was the first time that Ralph had ever seen General Mungo St. John at King's Lynn. There had once been a relationship between the lean, grizzled soldier, with the dark and wicked single eye, and Louise Ballantyne, Ralph's stepmother. That had been many years ago, long before Ralph had left Kimberley for the North. Ralph had never entirely fathomed that relationship, nor somehow the breath of scandal clouding it. But it was significant that Louise Ballantyne was not in the room, and that there was no place set at the table for her. If Mr. Rhodes had insisted that St. John was present at this gathering, and Zuga Ballantyne had agreed to invite him, then there was a compelling reason for it. Mungo St. John flashed that wolfish smile at Ralph as they shook hands. Despite the family complications, Ralph had always had a sneaking admiration for this romantically piratical figure, and his answering smile was genuine. The stature of the other men at the table confirmed the importance and significance of this gathering. Ralph guessed that the meeting was being held here to preserve the absolute secrecy that they could not always have assumed in the town of Bulawayo. He guessed also that every guest had been personally selected and invited by Mr. Rhodes rather than by his father. Apart from Jamieson and St. John, there was Percy Fitzpatrick, a partner of the Corner House Mining Group, and prominent representative of the Witwatersrand Chamber of Mines, the organ of the Gold Barons of Johannesburg. He was a lively and personable young man with a fair complexion and ruddy hair and moustache, whose checkered career had included bank clerk, transport rider, citrus farmer, guide to Lord Randolph Churchill's Africa expedition, author and mining magnate. Many years later, Ralph would reflect on the irony of this extraordinary man's claim to immortality being founded on a sentimental book about a dog called Jock. Beyond Fitzpatrick sat the Honourable Bobby White, who had just visited Johannesburg at Mr. Rhodes's suggestion. He was a handsome and pleasant young aristocrat, the type of Englishman that Mr. Rhodes preferred. He was also a staff officer and a career soldier, as his mess tunic revealed. Next to him sat John Willoughby, second in command of the original pioneer column, which had taken occupation of Fort Salisbury and Mashonaland. He had also ridden with Jamieson's column that had destroyed Lobengula, and his Willoughby's consolidated company owned almost 1 million acres of prime pastoral land in Rhodesia, a rival to Ralph's Rowland's company. So their greetings were guarded. Then there was Dr. Rutherford Harris, the first secretary of the British South Africa Company, and a member of Mr. Rhodes's political party, in which he represented the Kimberley constituency in the Cape Parliament. He was a taciturn grey man with a sinister cast of eye, and Ralph mistrusted him as one of Mr. Rhodes's slavish minions. At the end of the table, Ralph came face to face with his brother Jordan, and he hesitated for just a fraction of a second until he saw the desperate appeal in Jordan's gentle eyes. Then he gripped his brother's hand briefly, but he did not smile, and his voice was cool and impersonal as he greeted him like a mere acquaintance, and then took the place that a servant in a white Kanza uniform and scarlet sash had hurriedly laid beside Zuga at the head of the table.